And joining us on the book club today is award-winning author, New York Times bestselling author, Daniel James Brown. Daniel is the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, The Boys in the Boat, as well as The Indifferent Stars Above and Under a Flaming Sky. His current novel, his current book is Facing the Mountain, a true story of Japanese-American heroes in World War II. Daniel, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about yourself growing up. Were you a big reader? Did your family encourage you to read and write? How did this all start?
Oh, yes. I've been a reader all my life. One of my earliest and fondest memories is of my mother reading a book to me called Danny and the Dinosaur. And because my name is Dan and I love dinosaurs, I still remember that. I grew up in the Bay Area, loving to read. I was an English major in college. I wound up actually teaching college English for a number of years, teaching literature and composition. And so in the back of my mind, I had always wanted to write a book, although I didn't actually get started as a writer until I was in my mid-50s.
And the first book that you bought, was that Under a Flaming Sky?
Yes, that was my first book. I was working as a software technical writer and editor at the time, and I wrote it sort of as a hobby. It involved some family history of mine and a dramatic forest fire in Minnesota, and I just thought it would be interesting to see if I could write a book about it. So I sat down and I didn't have an agent or an editor or a publisher. I just sat down and wrote the book over the course of about a year and a half, not really expecting to get published. And to my surprise, it eventually did get published on a sort of small scale. And that just sort of one thing led to another. Then that book led to another book with a large publisher, and so that led to The Boys in the Boat, and that led to the book I'm just releasing now.
Well, the one that I want to talk about right now as well is The Indifferent Stars Above, about the Donner Party. And a lot of people may not be that familiar with the Donner Party, except for perhaps a movie, but not really know the entire story. You take us there, and it's like we're in the party ourselves.
Well, part of what I try to do as a writer is to be very immersive in the small details, and I try to focus on a small number of individuals rather than just writing a sort of sweeping history. I try to tell personal stories. So in that case, I focused on a young woman named Sarah Graves, who was just 21 and actually left her home in Illinois with her newlywed husband on what turned out to be the ill-fated Donner Party expedition trying to get to California. And of course, they became snowbound in the Sierra Nevada mountains, and absolutely terrible conditions ensued. And most people know the story because of sort of the horrors. There was some cannibalism involved as they tried to survive. But I focused actually more on this young woman and a number of other relatively young, relatively healthy people who tried to hike out of the mountains that winter, over the mountains, and get through to California to let people in California know what was happening up in the mountains. She was one of a very small number of people that survived that attempt and did make it down out of the mountains and caused the first rescue expedition to be launched up into the mountains to reach the Donner Party.
We're visiting with award-winning author, New York Times bestselling author, Daniel James Brown. His current book is Facing the Mountains. Now, the book previously, before this one, was Boys in the Boat. Fascinating book. How did you get interested in this particular story?
That one actually grew out of just happenstance. My neighbor, we live on a five-acre parcel, so they're large pieces of land, but down across the pasture and over the fence is my neighbor, Judy. Her father was Joe Rance, who was one of the nine young men that I write about in that book, who went on to win an Olympic gold medal in rowing in Berlin in 1936. But I got interested in that story simply by talking to Judy. She introduced me to her father actually in the last couple months of his life. And so I was able to spend some time talking to him. And then through Judy, I got to meet the family members of the other eight young men who were in that boat and part of that story. And so that one just all came together sort of through happenstance that I happened to live next door to one of the really the principal protagonist in the book.
The book itself, it's also available in audio, and I like to read, but I also like to listen to a lot of audio books. And I heard the audio version of Boys in the Boat before I read the book. And the way the story is told, the narrative is just incredible. It's the story of these young men, but in some parts, I thought it was kind of like almost a Rocky Balboa story, because these guys were the underdogs.
They were very much the underdogs, and they were very much typical of a whole generation of Americans during the Depression who felt like underdogs. You know, the Depression took a terrible toll on many American families, and these kids were young working class families from Washington State. These kids grew up on dairy farms and working on fishing boats here in the Northwest, and they were having a really hard time making it in the world. And it was their participation in that rowing team that began to redeem their lives in a lot of ways. And so they sort of stood in for that generation of Americans, I think, who faced those hard times and found a way through them and learned to persevere through those really, really tough times. And more importantly, learned to pull together with other people to get through them. So the book in many ways becomes a metaphor, I think, for that, you know, that generation of Americans that, Tom Brokaw called them the greatest generation. My book's really just sort of a different spin on that same theme.
When you were talking to Joe, did you see anything that perhaps all of a sudden, you know, sometimes when we talk to our grandfathers or our fathers and we ask them about, tell us about this situation, all of a sudden their eyes light up and they become almost filled with life because they wanted to tell you that story.
Yeah. You know, that did happen with Joe. He was literally dying when I met him. He was living under hospice care at Judy's house. And as I said, he was in the last couple months of his life. He was on oxygen and he was quite weak. But you could see in his eyes when he talked about this story, what he had done in his youth, it really lit him up. And it was emotional for me just meeting Joe and talking to him, because his story was very much like my father's. My father was born the same year that Joe Rance was born. And although he was not a rower, he lived through very similar circumstances as a young man. His father died when he was just at the beginning of the Depression, which left his mother with a bunch of young kids to raise. And so as Joe was telling his story, it resonated with me, partly because it sounded so much like my own father's story. It was really easy to connect with Joe.
And if it hadn't been for you and talking to Joe, I would imagine that very few people even knew about the story.
Yeah, it was really on its way to being lost entirely. I mean, the story was well known here in Seattle in the 1930s, right after it happened. There was quite a bit made about it. But, you know, as the decades passed and these men grew older and began to die, the story really was dying too. And it was, as I say, it was just happenstance that that I met Judy, and she started talking about her father, invited me to come talk to him, and that's how that book got going. It was just sheer chance.
We're visiting with New York Times bestselling author, award-winning author, Daniel James Brown. He is the author of the book, The Boys in the Boat. His most recent book is Facing the Mountain. Now, this book in particular, it seems like it's very timely also the way it was released, because of what we've seen happening to Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders in the United States and in some parts of the world.
Yes, I had no idea when I started this book 5 years ago how timely it was going to turn out to be. Although it is true that as I was writing the book, I was seeing a lot of echoes between what was happening to these Japanese-American families that I was writing about back in the 40s and what has been going on in the country. At the time I was researching, writing about, and talking to these families about their immigrant parents or grandparents' experience coming to this country, was the same time that the previous administration Muslim ban was being bandied about, and there was all this rhetoric about immigrants. Later, when I was researching, writing, talking to people about the incarceration of Japanese-American people during World War II in these camps, that was about the same time that families were being torn apart on the southern border. So there were a lot of echoes, even as I was writing the book, between the history that I was writing about and, you know, what I was seeing on the evening news in my own world.
We're visiting with Daniel James Brown. Daniel is a New York Times bestselling author of The Boys in the Boat. His latest book is Facing the Mountain, a true story of Japanese-American heroes in World War II. We talked about the different racial tensions going on in the United States and other parts of the world against Asian Americans. But it, as you point out, this did not start with this book. This goes back all the way to the Gold Rush.
It goes back, yes, very, very specifically, in fact, to the Gold Rush in 1849 and then the 1850s. There were large numbers of Chinese immigrants that came to California to work in the gold fields or in supporting businesses, endeavors like building the railroads and so forth. And those Chinese immigrants were met almost immediately by a great deal of violence. There were lynchings and burnings, and people were driven out of their homes and out of towns. And there was a lot of rhetoric that arose around that in the 1850s. But then also, by the turn of the 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century, there arose this notion in newspapers and in also in Hollywood films a little later about this notion of what they called the yellow peril, this idea that Asian immigrants were equated with insects and rats and snakes and vermin and disease in particular. And those images and those ideas and those sort of tropes became very widespread in the American consciousness through the media early in the 20th century. And then, of course, part of what happened in the wake of Pearl Harbor was those same racist images and tropes and associations were immediately pulled out and sort of recycled and directed against Japanese Americans. Shortly, you know, in the immediate aftermath and of Pearl Harbor and all through the war. And, you know, in some ways, they're still with us. Those same associations and images, as you said, they've been there all along. They just keep getting recycled. And I think what we've seen here most recently is just some of the same images and phrases and ideas being brought up again.
We're visiting with New York Times bestselling author, award-winning author Daniel James Brown. His latest book is Facing the Mountain, a true story of Japanese-American heroes in World War II. As you told us earlier, Daniel, you like to write your books through the perspective of people. And you, we are introduced to four young men in your book. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so I wound up focusing on four young men, Japanese-American men, all of whom faced, as almost all draft-age Japanese-American faced, the same dilemma in the aftermath of Pearl Harbor. And the dilemma is their families were being incarcerated in these camps. They were being forcibly removed from their homes. They were having to walk away from their businesses. They were being forced to sell their possessions for pennies on the dollar. They were having to abandon beloved pets, and so on. At the same time, like millions of other young American men, a lot of them wanted to serve their country by joining the military. And they were not allowed to initially. people of Japanese ancestry were simply not allowed to enlist in the aftermath of Pearl Harbor. So they faced this dilemma: what does it mean to be a Japanese American? How do I show my patriotism? What is the right thing for me to do in this situation? For some of them, a year later, when the government reversed course and created an all Japanese American military unit called the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, for some of them, the decision was to enlist in that unit and to fight in order to demonstrate their loyalty to the country and to make the same sacrifice that other young Americans were making. For others, including many of those living in these camps, the decision was different. They felt that it was wrong to fight for the government that had imprisoned their parents and their grandparents and themselves, their brothers and their sisters. And so they felt the right thing to do was to resist service, even later when they were conscripted into the army, and to resist the incarcerations of their families as best they could. So there was this dilemma, and the book really traces the way that these four different young men dealt with that dilemma.
One of the young men became a Quaker, is that correct?
Yeah, so Gordon Hirabayashi was a Quaker, and actually he was a conscientious objector even before World War II started. He was a student at the University of Washington in Seattle when the war broke out. And amongst other things that happened, a curfew, an 8 p.m. curfew, was imposed on anybody of Japanese descent, American or not, in Seattle. They were not allowed to be out on the streets after 8 p.m. Gordon was a young man of very strong principles. Gordon decided he wasn't going to obey that curfew because it was racially motivated. So he actually, in fact, began to keep a journal in which he documented the occasions on which he was staying out after 8 p.m. And then when it came time for Japanese Americans in Seattle to get on buses and be taken off to these camps, Gordon just didn't get on the bus. Instead, he sat down and he wrote this long, very carefully reasoned statement outlining why he felt both the curfew and the incarcerations were wrong and illegal and unconstitutional. And he took that statement, he went downtown Seattle to the FBI offices, walked in and handed them the statement and turned himself in. And that began a legal battle that went on through pretty much the course of the whole war. Gordon was kept for a while in the King County Jail in Seattle. Later, he was at a work prison farm in Tucson, Arizona, and eventually wound up in a federal prison in Washington State. But all the while, his legal case was working its way up to the United States Supreme Court, where actually he lost. And in the long run, though, he was vindicated. His case, decades later, was vacated by the Supreme Court. And after Gordon died, actually, President Obama awarded him the Presidential Medal of Freedom for this principled stand he had taken during the war.
We're visiting with New York Times bestselling author, award-winning author Daniel James Brown. His latest book is Facing the Mountain, a true story of Japanese-American heroes in World War II. One of the young men, I think it was Mr. Shiosaki, he said that they were fighting, they joined, and they had the right to be called an American, not a hyphenated American.
Yeah, and that was common. Amongst those who chose, when it was finally created, chose to join the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. One of the reasons, they had various reasons for doing that, but one of the common reasons that these young men volunteered, some of them even coming out of the camps, was they felt that if they fought and bled and even in many cases died on the battlefields of Europe, that they would win the right to be considered fully American, which they had not been up to that point. Even though they were, of course, American. They felt that by making this sacrifice, it would or it should earn them the right to take that hyphen out of their designation and simply really be called Americans. And so a lot of them went off to war with that in mind.
Isn't it interesting, though, that now in these current times, we do have a lot of hyphenated Americans, whether it be Japanese American, Mexican American, Asian American, African American. It seems like that is coming back in a way.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that when the Japanese American soldiers came back from the war, they came back pretty much to an unchanged situation. There were some newsreels that celebrated their extraordinary accomplishments during the war, but most of them came home to find, reunite with their families that had just been released from these camps and trying to go back to communities they had been forced out of. It wasn't that much changed for them. They largely faced the same kinds of discrimination that they had faced before the war, despite what they had done in the war and the conditions they had endured. So it didn't really win them the degree of respect that they had hoped. There were exceptions to this, but in large part, it didn't fully accomplish what they had hoped it would accomplish.
But they were one of the most decorated units in their size, correct?
Yes, actually, they were one of, if not the most decorated unit of its size, not just in World War II, but in all of American military history. They displayed extreme valor on the battlefields in Europe, and they also suffered an extreme number of casualties. They made enormous sacrifices.
One of the young men that you mentioned in the book, and I'm not sure if I saw the picture in the book or online, but where it shows that they had just captured some enemies and they're leading them to the camp.
That was Rudy Tokiwa, a young man who grew up in Salinas, California on a farm. His family was incarcerated in the Poston, Arizona camp, particularly bleak and hot and miserable place. Rudy was one of the young men who volunteered out of the camps for the 442nd and fought in Italy, France, and then back in Italy again. And yeah, Rudy was a really interesting guy. His army name was Punch Drunk. He kind of tended to get in trouble a lot, didn't always follow the rules, but he had this huge heart. Rudy was pretty good at sort of sneaking behind enemy lines, and he was a number of times tasked with getting behind enemy lines and gathering intelligence, or in one occasion, they wanted to try to capture some German officers so they could get some intelligence from them. And Rudy pulled it off. He spent several nights sleeping out in bushes behind German lines and finally found an opportunity to ambush and single-handedly capture a half a dozen German officers and march them back into the American side of the lines.
We're visiting with Daniel James Brown. Daniel is a New York Times bestselling author and award-winning author. His latest book is Facing the Mountain, A True Story of Japanese Americans, Heroes in World War II. Now, when you go back to what we were talking about earlier about the racial injustice that's happening currently against Asian Americans, we've seen it against Italians, we've seen it against Irish, we've seen it against Mexican Americans, we've seen it. It's just gone back and forth throughout the United States. But Mr. Shiosaki recently died. He was the last one, is that correct, of 96 years old?
Yeah, so of the four men that I profile in the book, Fred was the only one who was actually still alive when I began the project, and I was able to spend quite a bit of time with Fred and his son Michael talking about the war. Fred was just this amazingly spirited man, also enormously humble man, considering all that he had been through and all he had done. But he just had this fighting spirit. He grew up in Hilliard, which is a sort of poorer part of Spokane, Washington, down by the railroad yards. And when he was growing up, it was a largely immigrant neighborhood, and there were people from all over the world there. And because of that, a lot of racial slurs got thrown around in Hilliard. And Fred, although he was a kid that didn't really like to fight, he would not abide racial slurs when they were hurled at him. So he got in a lot of scraps as a kid. In fact, he kept coming home with broken eyeglasses, and his father, who ran a laundry, was in despair because he kept having to buy Fred new sets of eyeglasses to replace the ones from the latest scrap that Fred had gotten into.
The Japanese in stories, documentaries, movies that we have seen, they have honor as a big thing in their culture, in their life. And so in your book, you also mentioned that some of these people, they thought it would be an honor to go and die for their country in Europe somewhere instead of staying home.
Yes. So, I mean, although they were thoroughly American, these kids had grown up in Japanese families, and they did have certain Japanese values as part of their system. Almost universally, when these young men, those who signed up to serve, went off to war, the last thing their fathers in particular told them over and over again was, well, do well, fight well, I hope you aren't injured, but whatever you do, don't bring shame on the family. And these guys took that seriously. So they went into battle with that attitude that they were not only fighting for their country, but they were also wanted to be sure that they didn't bring shame upon themselves or their family members back home.
Daniel, was it a conscious decision to send them to the European theater and not the Pacific theater?
I think it probably was. I am not sure exactly what the military's motive was. I think they may not have trusted them to some extent, to some degree, to fight in the Pacific theater. Or it may also have been that they were very concerned that Japanese Americans, if they were captured by Japanese imperial troops, would be abused in particularly horrible ways, and they were actually trying to protect them. But yes, they sent them to Europe instead.
We have been visiting with award-winning author, New York Times best-selling author Daniel James Brown. His recent book is Facing the Mountain, a true story of Japanese-American heroes in World War II. As we talked also before, we discussed this book. He is the author of The Boys in the Boat, The Indifferent Stars Above, and Under a Flaming Sky. Now, Daniel, if people want to find out more about your books, and I think there's a tab that says more than the book or something like that, and then go in and find out more about Densho and other things that involve the history of the Japanese Americans. Is that correct?
Yes. If you go to danieljamesbrown.com, you will find all kinds of resources for learning more about the story.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. We appreciate this.
Thank you so much for having me.
We have been visiting with Daniel James Brown. Daniel's latest book is Facing the Mountain, a true story of Japanese-American heroes in World War II. The book club is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Sam Cassiano. You've been tuned to The Book Club. I'm Louis Sines.